Good morning. I'm Beverly, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Beverly.
Hey, Beverly.
And this is tough, y'all. God, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I am truly, truly not feeling all that great. My throat is hurting. I'm kind of losing my voice. I don't know if I'm getting sick, but whatever it is, I'm fighting. And my stomach don't feel too good. I don't drink none of them chocolate frosties from Wendy's. But anyway, gosh, it's this is weird. You know, I've never gotten up this time of night except for to go get high. You know, so I'm like leading the meeting at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you know, that other side of me was like, I'm not getting up. But honestly, you know, I couldn't sleep, and I know that I was the spirit, you know, that I pray to on a regular basis, and for the past almost 13 years, just would not let me rest, you know, and my conscience, you know, was like, you can't do that, because if it was a hit, you would be gone, you know, no problem, or a man, you know, so... but it's good to be here, and I really have enjoyed the sharing that I've heard so far. And I was just sitting there like, what am I going to talk about? I didn't even know what the topic was, so I got up and went outside and called Carol. I was like, what am I sharing about? You know, the real me. Will the real me stand up? You know, and what came to my mind is that this is the real me. You know, this. The person that you see truly, truly is the real me. And I'm just, you know, at the beginning of finding out, you know, who she is, you know, because I have not known pretty much for about 40 years. I have not known who the real me was. I covered up, wore masks, lived in a fantasy world, a facade for pretty much all my life. And it started very, very early, you know, in my life with my living status, because I didn't grow up with my mom. I was born in D.C., but was shipped off real early at the age of 3 to live with my grandparents. I got dropped off, you know, in a house full of people that I didn't know, and the only person that I did know, you know, she left, and I lived there for 7 years, and I hated it. I heard this somebody, I think it was the speaker, sharing about, you know, no running water, no bathroom, because I grew up on a farm in South Carolina, and we had to go to the spring to get water. We had took baths in a tin tub. We had an outhouse, and at night, you know, there was a bucket that we bought in to use, you know. And it was just crazy, you know. And I thought that that was okay until I found out that my cousins who lived down the road had a real bathroom, and they had a sink in their kitchen, and water came from it, and they didn't have to travel distances to go get water. And resentments and anger, hatred, I was like, what is going on, you know? And my life kind of progressed with those feelings. With every incident that happened, I was molested by my own uncle at about 5 years old. So, you know, that was a whole bunch of confusion, and some more hatred, some more resentments, you know. And it just progressed. I remember my mother finally having, she had 4 girls, and we were all growing up with my grandparents. And I talked about, you know, living in a fantasy. And the fantasy got created because of the hatred, you know, for the way that I was living. And I knew that other people weren't living like that. And, you know, so I started escaping through television, through fantasies in my own mind. And a monster was created. That's why I say this is the real me. Because there was another person that started to emerge. And I remember my mother having to come get us, finally, because my sister, my older sister, had finally had enough of, you know, my grandmother's shenanigans and fabrications about what life was supposed to be. And, you know, everything was a sin, and we were going to hell, and she went to Kingdom Hall and Baptist Church, and it was just crazy. And I remember, you know, the summers we used to come to the city, but we would always have to go back when it was time to go to school. So, you know, I was kind of happy for this big blowout between my grandmother and my sister, because my mom was forced to bring us back to D.C. to live. And I started sipping, you know, when I was about 8 years old, you know. And I remember, you know, like, the fantasy world that I had created, it got better, like, when I was, you know, when I took a drink, you know. When I came to the city and my, you know, to live with my mother, she had a bar, you know. So alcohol was real easy for me to get my hands on. So that happened when I was about 11. And it just progressed, you know. By the time I hit 13, junior high school, I was smoking, you know, weed. By the time I was 15, I was dropping LSD, smoking angel dust. By the time I got 19, I had tried cocaine, smoking coke for the first time. I snorted some heroin, you know, and I was like, wow, you know. But it just gave me a sense of escape, because also by that time, you know, through those years of progressing in my disease, I had gotten pregnant, you know, got rid of the baby, got pregnant again, and hid the pregnancy so that I could have this baby, dropped out of school. My mother had lost both her jobs and decided that she wanted a career as a full-fledged alcoholic. And it was five women growing up in one house, you know, and everybody was trying to have a boyfriend, you know, and it made for real, real bad living conditions. And it was just no guidance. My mother didn't have any rules, so I basically did what I wanted to do, you know. So I was running the streets, you know. It just took off. Finally, when I was 24, my last trip to the hospital with my mother kind of devastated me. And I remember sitting on the floor with her in my arms, and she was spitting up parts of her liver. She was bleeding from her rectum. She was bleeding from her nose. And I was hoping that that would be my last trip, because I was tired of seeing her suffer. And I never realized that I was headed down the same road, because, you know, I kind of stayed away from alcohol. Didn't really like the taste of it, but I would do it, you know, like, to get the feelings off and to be able to escape. But I said that I would never be an alcoholic, you know. That was my last trip to the hospital with her. And my disease really took off. Me and crack cocaine became the best of friends. And I looked up. It was about 5 years later. My daughter was living with her father and his wife. I was sleeping in my car. And whatever clothes that I had, you know, was on my back. And once that car was gone, when they finally towed it, you know, I ended up sleeping on the church steps outside, you know, across the street from a shelter, a women's shelter, that I could have easily went to and checked in. And that had been going on off and on for quite some time. You know, when I would get tired, I would go and stay at the shelter. And the sad part about it was that I had family, you know, that loved me so much. All I had to do was pick up the phone. But the shame and the guilt of what I had done to my own self wouldn't allow me, you know, to do it, to call them. I started having bouts with the law, because the more that my disease progressed, you know, the harder it became to get, you know, to be able to get drugs. So I started having to do things that was out of the norm, and a monster, you know, the monster got bigger, you know, because I started committing crimes, strong arm robbing people, tricking, you know, just anything that I needed to do to get high, you know. And I remember the first time I got arrested was for being in somebody's house. And I guess the person was probably running a crack house and got locked up, so they just shut the house down. Of course, you know, we break into them kind of houses and make them our homes, you know, and turn them into crack houses. And I remember that morning coming to, and the police was there, and everybody in the house went to jail. And I was standing before the judge that Monday morning, because it happened on a Friday, of course. You know, so I, you know, that was my first time in Central Cell Block. I was 29 years old, you know, and them bologna sandwiches and that juice tasted good, because I hadn't eaten anything in so long, you know. So I was waiting, you know, for them sandwiches. But, you know, I remember standing in front of the judge and him asking me, you know, why you wait till 29? You're 29 years old, you know. Why you wait till now, you know, to get in trouble with the law, you know. And I remember telling him that I had a drug problem, and he sent me to treatment, you know. And I did 30 days and got out, went right back to the same people, same place, and did the same thing all over again. So that went on, you know, back and forth, you know, till I ended up with 3 felonies and 3 misdemeanors. And, you know, now I got gun possession, and I ain't never had a pistol, you know what I'm saying? But I got gun possession on my record. Dude, they just like, they just stick stuff in there. And I was like, where all this shit go? I don't even care no more now, you know. But I was wondering where all this stuff was coming from. But, you know, once them people get a hold of your life, ain't no telling where you might end up at. But anyway, luckily, they only sent me, you know, to D.C. jail. Thank God for that. Because, you know, girls was talking about going to federal penitentiaries and all that, you know. But thank God I never had to go through that. They just confined me to D.C. jail. After going through all of that and finding myself, I left the church steps, and, you know, that was in Northwest, and I went to Northeast. I hung over there for a little while. Then I went to Southeast. I hung over there for a little while. I lived with my uncle, the same uncle that molested me. And I remember, you know, I was smoking crack, getting high, drinking up his liquor, stealing his money. But at night when it was time for me, or whenever I would decide to try to get some rest, I would lock the door. I would lock the door, you know, because I didn't trust him, you know. And I remember, you know, all the hatred and anger that I would feel, you know. And I, you know, there was a feeling inside me. I said, I know that bastard. He remember. You know what he did to me. You know, just crazy. So I felt like, you know, it was justified. You know, I need to take every dime I can get, you know. And he would know that it was me. Wasn't nobody in the house but me and him. You know, and he would get up and, but he would never accuse me of stealing his money, you know. So I said, yeah, you know. That's why he can't say nothing, you know, crazy. But anyway, but I remember going back to jail and doing, like, after the third week of me being back in D.C. jail again for I don't know how many times, they had to release me, you know, because I had did the time on the charge. So it was a mandatory release. And this time, and they had never did this before. Usually they make you leave in that jumpsuit. This time they gave me some fatigues. And I remember walking out of that jail, and I walked across East Capitol Street, that little bridge part, and went back to my uncle's house. But I remember feeling like I ain't never going back to jail no more. I can't do jail, you know, because I like my freedom. And I think I continued in my destruction for about another year, and I found myself right back at that church again, you know. But this time I was like, something got to change. I'm sick of this, you know. So I, instead of going to the church, I ended up walking around in the neighborhood, ran into this guy, ended up in the crack house for about 4 days, you know, and I woke up in this big old four-story house, you know, and didn't know whose house I was in. Everybody was gone. I was the only person in that house, and the most eeriest feeling came over me. And I think for the first time, I feared for my life. I really feared for my life. And I remember walking out of that house, and I went and I asked the people at the shelter if I could, you know, get a bed. You know, I had a plan. My plan was that I was going to get in the day shelter. You know, when the day shelter closed, I go across the street, because they was right across the street from each other. I go across the street, check in the night shelter, and then in the morning when they put me out, I just go back across the street to the day shelter, and maybe I could stay clean. But what happened, this lady that I used to get drunk with, you know, had about 3 years clean, and she helped me get in the program. She was like, nah, you know, we're going to do an intake on her. You know, and they did an intake, and they, you know, they had never did that before. And I had utilized that shelter for about 6 or 7 years. But this particular time, they did an intake. You know, they got some papers, some forms, and they started asking me all these questions, and the lady was writing stuff down. But that was after, let me say that was after they pushed me off, you know, to the shower, go take a bath. Let her go take a bath first, and then we'll take care of the paperwork, you know. And I remember I had a backpack on my back. I had one change of clothes, and the ones that I took off went in the trash. I put those on and threw the bag in the trash too, you know. And I said, okay, well, I know I can get some clothes, you know, from the shelter. But anyway, the lady started asking me all these questions, and for the first time I started telling somebody the truth about how I had been living. I had been sleeping outside. You know, she was asking me, like, how much drugs did you do? You know, and I was like, I have no idea. Just a lot. You know, more. I exceeded whatever the maximum was. You know, shit. 'Cause I'm serious. I would take excursions with people. I would run into a guy. And if he had the right kind of money, look, wherever he wanted to take me, I ended up all the way down in Baltimore some damn where, you know. And I was with this man for about 4 or 5 days. Crazy, you know what I'm saying? He could have killed me, you know. But God was truly watching over me. But, you know, so I ended up in treatment. And I haven't looked back. And that was in 1994, July the 15th. And I have not looked back. I'm going to bring it up to what's going on right now. You know, let me say this first. I did exactly what they told me to do. You know, from the first day I walked into treatment, wasn't no bucking, wasn't no, I don't feel like I need to be doing that. Why are you trying to run my life? It was not, my willingness was whatever. You know, okay. You know, I had to go to meetings twice a day. I couldn't go to a meeting by myself. I had to have one of my sisters with me. I was living in a house with people that had mental problems. I did not identify out. I knew that something was mentally wrong with me, because normal people don't do the type of stuff that I was doing. You know, and I was in a whole lot of pain. You know, during the course of my addiction, I tried to commit suicide a couple of times. That's why I could identify with people that was on Haldo and Cogentin and all. I didn't identify out, you know, because I probably needed a dose or two myself, you know. And they sent me off to therapy just like they sent them. And, you know, I was fortunate. God watched over me where I didn't have to be on medication. I was stable enough, but I still had some clinical depression, you know, some bouts of clinical depression, and I still do today, and I know when it hits me because I'm aware of it. But I lost my train of thought, but I guess it'll come back. Anyway, I did exactly what they told me to do. You know, I went to meetings. I got a sponsor. I couldn't help nobody. You know, all I could do was manage to make it to meetings and, you know, just, you know, hope through the day that I wouldn't, that the feeling to want to use didn't overpower me. And I, you know, asked this lady to sponsor me. And the hard part, or the painful part for me, in those things that they told me to do was to pray, because all of my faith in God was gone by the time I got to Narcotics Anonymous. I was so full of anger and hatred, self-hatred, hatred for people, because folks is cruel. They cruel, you know. But I, you know, I was cruel too, you know. But they said stuff like, just say thank you at the end of the day, you know. People told me, they said, get on your knees, you know. And I would forget at night. So they said, when you take your bedroom slippers off, kick them underneath the bed, you know. So you got to get on your knees in the morning to get them, you know. And I did that, you know. So each morning when I get up, because I did it every day for so long, I don't have to put them under the bed no more. I just automatically roll out my bed to my knees in the mornings when I get up. And I pray. You know, I pray and I thank God for waking me up. But I got a sponsor. I went through a couple of sponsors, and then I started praying, and I asked God to put somebody in my life that could help me, because I had about 3 years clean, 3 or 4 years clean, and I knew that I wasn't getting it. You know what I'm saying? Like, with the step work, it was something missing, something wasn't connecting, and I started feeling like if I didn't get some help, you know, that I was going to use again. And that scared me more than anything. And then I read it in the literature, so that kind of, like, reconfirmed, you know, what I was feeling. So I started praying, and God put this wonderful woman in my life that took me through the steps, you know, and It was an awesome experience. I started connecting, like, my emotions and why I reacted to life the way I did to everything that happened to me throughout my life, you know, and throughout my addiction. I was able to kind of put it together and clear up some of the confusion that was going on in my head about why I couldn't deal with life, why I couldn't function, why I couldn't be a good mother to my daughter, a good sister to my sisters, a good daughter to my mother. You know, it helped me understand, like, the disease that my mother was bouting with. She tried to get clean, and I had forgotten her. I couldn't see that part. I had forgotten about that. But once I got clean and started, like, you know, doing some work, I started, you know, remembering that she did try to get clean. You know, she went to treatment for a whole year. She got out. She stayed clean for 3 weeks. And that was her last bout. You know, she gave up. You know, she gave up. But I understand, you know, I went through a forgiveness process. I had to. I had to forgive my mother. I had to forgive myself. I had to forgive my uncle, you know, and all of the people that I hurt, you know. And I also had to pray for the people that I had hurt to forgive me, you know, because I did a lot of damage too, you know, to a lot of people who cared about me, to a lot of people who didn't even know me, you know. You know, I when I was in treatment, you know, after I had probably about maybe 30 days, they sat me down and they said, you know, you need to figure out what you want to do with your life, you know. And they said you need to write down some goals, some long-term goals and some short-term goals. And one of my short-term goals was that I wanted a high school diploma, because I dropped out of school. You know, I just didn't give a shit. I was getting high and hanging out. I didn't have time. And I beat myself up for 20 years because I was the only one of my siblings that did not graduate from high school. And that was a big my mother, I thought it was such a big disappointment for my mother, but it was a big disappointment for me, you know. In my first year, I got a GED, you know. And I was like, I was blown. That was a turning point in my recovery, a major turning point, because the substance abuse counselor, you know, when I told him that that was one of the things I wanted to do, she set it up. Me and my thinking, I was ready to go back to school. And she said that I don't think you need to go to school. I think you have what it takes to do this. And I took that test and passed it with high scores, you know. one of my long-term goals was that I wanted to work in hotel management, you know, and today I've been on my job 11 years and I'm an event manager for one of the biggest hotel chains in the world. And it's awesome, you know. I started out on that job as a waitress, you know, setting up ballrooms and cleaning up after folks. And the day I have my own office, I've gotten about 5 or 6 promotions. So I have a career today, not just a job. And it gets on my goddamn nerves. I ain't lying. Them people work my fucking nerves. I swear they do, you know. And my gratitude goes out the window sometimes. And then I have to come back and say, God, please forgive me. Lord knows, because I appreciate my job, but they work my nerves. Because I tell you, folks is feeling like you need to do this for me because I'm spending all this money. You know, some of them really want you to kiss their ass, and I'm not an ass because I work too hard on my job, you know. And I'm just not that kind of person, you know what I'm saying? I can't brown nose and... You know, if I'm doing my job and I have wonderful hospitality skills, you know what I'm saying? But some people want you to just give a little too much and they get upset and want to email my general manager because I ain't returned their phone call like right then and there. And I'm like, fuck you. I don't say that to them, but in my mind, and I close my door sometimes and cuss their ass out, you know, but then I come back and I be like, God, you know, I'm sorry, you know. Because sometimes, you know, the other girl, because there's two, she comes out, you know, she comes out, Beverly and Beverly. I ain't never had an alias. I've always been Beverly, you know what I'm saying? Other people have given me names that just never stuck, like Slim, you know, Bone, Slick. Whatever, you know, Ollie, shut up. But, you know, but I'm grateful. I'm really grateful for my job, you know, I really am. And God knows that I am in my heart, you know, he knows that I am. So, you know, I always share about that because, you know, I want people to know that recovery is really about living your dreams. You know, and one of the other things that my heart really desired that I didn't put down on paper, but I kind of knew that I wanted, was to have a home and to have a husband, a mate that I could live my life out with. I wanted somebody to be able to enjoy the things that God has given me. In 1999, I won a house in a lottery. I didn't even ask for it. I wasn't even looking. I had a beautiful 2-bedroom apartment, living on the 7th floor, and I remember the first night that I moved into my first apartment ever in my life, I was staring at the steeple of the church steps that I used to sleep on, you know, and I had my own private parking space that I did not have to pay for. All I did was gave them $25 for the remote. I could watch the fireworks from the rooftop. I was 7 blocks away from my job. I was good. But somebody in the program said, I can't get up there. They're giving these applications out. I'm trying to get a house. Can you stop and get me an application? Because it was in my neighborhood. Sure, you know. And when I gave them the application, said, why don't you copy it and fill one out, you know. And I did. And then he said, you know, from there, they told me what else to do. So I just followed the procedure and ended up with a house, you know, a cute little house. Now here's the funny thing, you know, people in recovery, they say the stuff that people say, like the cliches and stuff they share it because it's true, you know. They sent me a paper in the mail when I was in that process. And on the paper, it had 3 houses, right? And I picked the house off of the paper, and I said, this is the one that I want, right? It was something that I could afford, you know, and I paid about $250 total out of pocket, and the house was mine. So I had, you know, they sent me to school and all that stuff, and I got a loan and had the house redone. It's really a cute house. It's really nice. When I went to see the house, I realized when I got to the street that it was on, that it was three other houses on the block that I had been in smoking crack and tricking. And I was like, God damn. And right on the other side of the avenue was where I got high. Like, I really hit my bottom in that area, Park Road. And I was like, wow, this is the same thing that happened to me when I moved into the apartment on 14th Street. You know what I'm saying? And I was seeing people, you know, I still see them, people that I, you know, used to get high with, you know. And I don't get caught up, you know, I just don't get caught up. I guess the other part of that dream came true about, what, less than 48 hours ago, I got married.
Did you?
Yeah. Thursday, and really less than 2 days. And I have had such a struggle with relationships because I have trust issues. And I am very well aware where they came from. They came from my mother leaving me with people that I didn't know. Even though they were relatives, I was not properly introduced. You know, it came from the abandonment that I felt by her leaving me there. Insecurities set in, strong insecurities and trust issues when my uncle did what he did to me. So I didn't trust anybody, you know. So I let people in my life, you know, and they good. They real good. I'm mild-mannered. I'm sweet. I will give you my last, but if you cross me, there is a price. So that is the other Beverly comes out. She comes out, and boy, ooh, me and this man been through some stuff, you know. But I remember in my eighth year, I was at that door of getting married, you know, and really didn't trust the guy that I was with, you know. There was something that just wasn't clicking, you know. And we had set a couple of dates, and they came, and they went, and it just wasn't any planning or any of that. But I remember when that relationship ended, and it ended because my trust issues would not allow me to give him 30 days to leave, nigga, get the fuck out. You know what I'm saying? That my sponsor kept saying, you gotta find a gray area, you know. And at that time, I was in the process of 6 and 7 and 8, you know. So all of the stuff that was being revealed to me was coming out. You know what I'm saying? It's not so much that he was doing anything wrong, you know. I just couldn't see anything right because my life was in shambles. After doing a fifth step, it probably took me I got to the 10th step before I started realizing and kind of piecing stuff together. And it really didn't become clear until after I had sat with self, you know, about a year after that relationship was finally over, because it took me about another year or two to get out of it completely, because we were still sleeping together, you know. And I'm not all right with that kind of stuff, you know. But when my emotions are caught up, I will allow myself to be used as a doormat, knowing that that's all I'm going to get when I know I want more, you know. So then I'll do shit like, you know, blame him, because I'll say, you know, I'm scorned, why you fucking with me? And I'll throw a rock through the window. You know what I'm saying? So that's the other Beverly, you know. I don't want to live like that no more. But I remember wanting to drive my truck off of South Capitol Bridge. You know, I remember I wanted to go use because the pain was so great, you know. But I didn't. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was up all night. I was taking off days from work. I lost like 35 pounds. People thought I was using, but I was going through. I was keeping folks up on the phone at night, but I did not get high, you know. And when I got to the other, one morning I woke up and I realized I was on the other side, you know. And then when I started to really, when I went to Germany for 3 weeks. And during that trip, I realized that I did not want to do this shit anymore. And when I came back, I had one more bout with this person. And I said, that's it. I'm through using, you know. And I sat with self until the man that I married came into my life. And that's when, during that period when I was by myself, a lot of this stuff started to make sense with all of the work that I had done, all of the writing, all of the praying, all of the tears. It all started coming together and started to make sense. You know, I've learned so much, you know. Sponsorship is so vitally important, so vitally important. Had I not been in the process of step work, the feelings and emotional roller coaster that I was on, I would not have been able to get through it clean had I not been doing some self-examination. Because some of the stuff made sense, but the pain, good God, the pain. But I'm going to tell you something. Well, this is one of the things that I, well, this was one of the most precious things that I realized once I really got to the other side, you know, completely. I realized that the pain that I was in wasn't coming from the breakup of that relationship. I thought it was, but it wasn't. It was coming from the fact that I had been introduced to me. And remember, I told you I lived in a fantasy world. And I wore a mask for a long time, and it had been taken off. I had been stripped, and I was not this nice, loving, caring, pretty, witty, whatever person I had built up in my mind. You know, I was crazy. I was neurotic. Don't squeeze the toothpaste from the middle. Squeeze it from the bottom. Don't leave this toilet seat up. You know what I'm saying? I just, crazy. You know what I'm saying? And I found out that, that person, it hurt. It hurt, you know, because all of that stuff had been torn down, you know. If you knew, if you got time, a little bit, a lot, and you don't have a sponsor and not working the steps, you are missing out on one of the most wonderful blessings that this program has to offer. Please get a sponsor. Find out who you are. You know, it really saved my life. You know, I used to wonder how people get 15 years, 16 years, 10 years, 5 years, 20 years, and go out. Go back to that madness. And now I know why. Because the emotional turmoil from our past and what life will present today will take us up out of here if we don't know. If I don't know who I am, you know, and why I feel like I feel, I will react to some shit, and I'll find myself in a place and be wondering how the hell I got there. You know, I don't want to live like that no more. So today, you know, I'm at peace. I'm finding a lot of peace because I keep my mouth shut. I don't react to every little feeling anymore. You know, I've learned how to pick my battles, you know, because some shit just ain't worth it. You know, and life has gotten a lot better, you know. I just encourage you, you know, to just get a sponsor and do some step work, because that's the program. And I was taught that early on, that is the program. All of the rest of the stuff that we do, going to dances, picnics, all this stuff, conventions, that's the fellowship, you know. But the steps is the program. Thanks for letting me share.